On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. My name is Mary Yelkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I will be serving as your moderator today. Today's training is an introduction to the ITRC guidance document, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. And we hope that you will spend some time exploring that document if you haven't already done so, and that it will become a resource and a tool for you to help you improve your job performance when you're working on environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items as we get started. Today's event is being recorded. We typically record our training classes, so if you are ever in a situation where you'd like to attend a training class, but we don't offer one when it's convenient for you, you can always go into our archives page. We have many, many archives available that you can listen to and access at your convenience. The trainers will be in control of their slides as they move through today's training. If you'd like your own copy of your slides, you can access that through the initial page you were directed to log into today. You can also access that through the related links section by clicking on CLUIN training page and then clicking Browse To. We do want to hear from everyone today. As we are participating in our training today, we want to get everyone providing us feedback. So we do have an online feedback form, and we would like you to take a few minutes at the end of today's training to complete that online feedback form. Also, if you're someone who needs documentation of continuing education, if you fill out that online feedback form, click the box to certify that you attended. A certificate of participation will be generated for you. At any time today during today's training, if you have a question for our trainers, please go ahead and type it in your Q&A box in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. That will come to us, and then we will either answer those back in writing, or as our time allows during our question-answer breaks, one in the middle and one at the end, we will respond to your questions verbally. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a state-led organization hosted by the Environmental Council of States. We are a network of state regulators working with our federal partners, including the Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. We work alongside our industry affiliates program members, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review the ITRC usage policy and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty material or endorse any specific products. We do have a variety of guidance documents, training classes, fact sheets, and many other types of material and resources on a variety of topics, so we encourage you to visit the ITRC website to learn more. Also, if you're interested in becoming a member of ITRC and participating in the development of our guidance documents or training classes, please check out the membership tab at itrcweb.org as well. At this point, it's my pleasure to introduce our trainers for today. All of them have been members of ITRC's geospatial analysis team. First, we'll be hearing from Dave Becker. He is with the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Adam Jansen with Barr Engineering Company, Chris Stubbs with Ramball, and Ali Firmal with the Washington State Department of Ecology. So we'll now move over to slide number 6, and I'm going to turn it over to Dave Becker. Dave, however, I am not seeing you in Adobe Connect. Are you able to get into Adobe Connect?
I'm not able to, and I was just going to mention that despite reloading the app and all kinds of stuff, I'm not able to do that. If you could be so kind as to advance the slides for me, I will.
I absolutely will.
Okay, excellent. So we are on slide 6, and we're at what I like to call a milepost slide. These slides kind of tell you where we're at in the overall scheme of the sequence of topics that we're going to cover today. And so it's my pleasure to cover the first couple items on the list there. So we'll start with this introduction and going to slide 7 now. I would pretty much bet $5 that most everybody on the call has at some point in their career used a geospatial method or the results of geospatial analysis. And I can say that fairly safely just because most everybody's had the opportunity to either create or use, interpret some type of computer-generated contour map. And these contour maps, when computer-generated, are pretty much always generated using some type of geospatial method and tool. So anytime you've done those kind of contour maps or used them, you've used geospatial analysis. The kinds of activities where these kind of contour maps are going to be prepared, you know, where we're contouring piezometric data to understand groundwater flow, obviously to contour contaminant concentrations in soil or groundwater, and for the geologists in a group, contouring any of the elevations of a contact between, say, different stratigraphic layers or whatever. Those are the kind of situations where you're going to run across those kind of things. If we can go to slide 8 now, I do want to emphasize that even though you're going to hear just a wonderful batch of information about geospatial methods, I do want to say that the context that we have for this presentation and for the related guidance document is optimization. So we really kind of want to emphasize the application of these methods to optimize the work we do in environmental cleanup projects. Okay, and you know, I think it's relevant to a lot of us on the call just because we are being asked by our supervisors, by our clients, to do more with less. To you know, resources are scarce. We have to use them very wisely, and optimization is a way to do that. Certainly, many federal agencies, including the Department of Defense and state agencies as well, actually have policies requiring that optimization be part of the process for these cleanup projects. In some cases, they focus on the sites that are in remediation, you know, after a decision document like a record of decision. In other cases, the optimization is actually integral to the many life cycle phases, even prior to deciding on what the remedy is going to be. And it certainly can be applied throughout the life cycle of these projects. It's nothing new for ITRC to be interested in the topic of remedy optimization. And in fact, there's a number of guidance documents and fact sheets related to remediation optimization that ITRC has provided. And actually, the third major bullet down there, you can see that bullet has an underlining, blue underlining. That is an active link, and that will take you to the page for the ITRC remediation process optimization team that has those guidance documents. And it's not just ITRC. There are other tools and guidance documents, references related to optimization that are available either on the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable optimization webpage or the very nice EPA CLUIN website related to optimization. And there are links on this slide as well for that. And I do kind of want to highlight that the Air Force has done a lot to provide some useful tools, particularly for monitoring optimization, that use these very geospatial analysis techniques. And so you'll maybe hear more about those. Let's go now to slide 9. I kind of want to put a pitch in here to really make you care about this topic. You know, how does this really relate to what we all do? Why should this matter to you? Well, certainly geospatial methods help us optimize our work. And it's always good to start with a definition of a term like optimization. So the term that I like, or the definition I like, is listed here, and it's related to a definition that the Environmental Protection Agency has. But I consider optimization to be anything that we do during anywhere within that life cycle of a project that where we identify and take actions that make things better, faster, cheaper, that they're more effective and cost efficient. Okay. So that's what we're talking about here. And just as an example of the kind of application to this very topic, if you look at the figures here to the right on slide 9, the upper two figures there, the one on the left shows a color-coded contour map of a particular parameter. Let's say that's concentrations of some contaminant. And that map was created using all the available sampling locations data points. The figure to its right, so it's the upper rightmost figure there, is another contour map that has been prepared with certain, actually 30 data points that have been, or up to 30 data points that have been excluded from the data set used to create that contour map. And by visually comparing, and even numerically comparing, as the bottom figure shows, there's not a whole lot of difference between those contour maps. And what we can infer from that is that we can, if our goal is to map the contaminant or whatever parameter, we can do so fairly accurately with fewer points. And so those dots on that upper rightmost figure are perhaps redundant data points that we don't need in order to create that kind of map. So this is an example of what we can do with geospatial methods that would have some impact on costs, in this case, maybe for monitoring. Let's go to slide 10. Let's talk more about how geospatial methods help you and why it should matter to you. We certainly do want to shepherd our resources carefully and achieve some cost savings, and these methods can help us do that by helping us in our planning process, particularly in terms, for example, of scoping our characterization and monitoring programs, kind of like the previous example. It can also help us in demonstration of the attainment of some type of cleanup goal as well. So doing that more effectively is optimizing and can have cost impacts. Geospatial methods are particularly powerful in helping us evaluate and interpret our data. These methods help us with the quality of data that we get through the improved planning that I just mentioned. But also it helps us by clarifying trends and patterns in data. And by understanding that, we can do our jobs better, things like coming up with better estimates of quantities, such as maybe the average concentrations for risk assessment or the volumes requiring remediation. Overall, the better the evaluation and interpretation of our data, the better our decisions are going to be and the more defensible they're going to be. Another way that geospatial methods can really help us is by communicating with others. The others can be our peers, other members of our project team, our client, or to the public and other stakeholders. A lot of the visualizations, like the contour maps that I mentioned before, three-dimensional visualizations of contaminant plumes or contaminated soil or whatever, pictures really are worth a thousand words, and so these tools that support those visualizations really can help us communicate what's going on at the site. Let's go to slide 11 now. As an example of how geospatial methods can help us in evaluating data and interpreting it, it certainly can help us understand the relationship between contamination and potential sources. And so here's an example shown on the figure to the right here of metals contaminant concentrations, in this case zinc, in a parcel of property located adjacent to a river. And the circles represent sampling locations, and the size of the circles represent sort of bins of concentrations for zinc in soil. And you can see just by looking at that upper map there, and this is a map view, that the larger circles tend to be concentrated nearest the river, and that the circles farther from the river tend to be smaller. So that would imply that perhaps there's a relationship between the river and the distribution of metals, including zinc, in the soil here. And the lower right graph is another way to visualize this kind of relationship, where you can see that if the x-axis is distance from the river and the y-axis is a logarithmic scale of concentrations of zinc, you can see that there's a clear downward trend in the concentrations as you move farther from the river, which just is a way of supporting our visual interpretation of the map above that. If we can go now to slide 12, just to reiterate the importance of geospatial methods and supporting visualizations for communicating ideas and plans to others. These tools can generate wonderful color splash, two-dimensional and three-dimensional images, and that allow us to rotate and view from different angles and with respect to other landmarks, different things. And the figure at the bottom here is an example of some soils targeted for excavation at a site, and you can see that it's been draped in three dimensions over a land surface with the superposition of different buildings or other features there that would help people understand the relationship of the excavation to different site features of importance. Let's go now to slide 13. And this is a good time for a poll question. It would be of interest to those of us who are instructing today, what roles our audience may play on a project where you might use geospatial analysis. So if you could indicate if you're a project manager that manages a team of folks that would conduct the analysis, if you're somebody who would be a reviewer of the output of some kind of geospatial analysis, or if you're a practitioner who would actually use the methods, apply them, and then present them, or if you're a stakeholder that would be interested in understanding where some of these outputs actually come from, that would really help us. And Mary, I can't see what the, how the poll is coming out, but we'll leave it up there for a little bit.
Yeah, and I can summarize that here, Dave. It says the leader is technical practitioner at about 40%, and then we have about 20% project manager, 25% technical reviewer, and a few others.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Obviously, we have a well-informed, probably, group on the line here. So all of us will take that into consideration as we go forward. Thank you very much for completing the poll question. There are multiple people in the room with you, if you could pick the one that is more representative of the folks that are present, that would be great. So. I guess we can go ahead and go to slide 14 at this point. I kind of want to, as part of this introduction, just emphasize sort of the nature of the accompanying guidance document for this topic. And it's an online, interactive type guidance, really useful. It helps you drill down to the pertinent information very rapidly. So this is available on the ITRC website, and I really encourage you to get that. It has just a ton of very useful information in it. Just to highlight a few things here, it has a number of fact sheets that address certain topics that would be of interest. So we have things like, do you need to have geospatial analysis, and are your conditions suitable for geospatial analysis, et cetera. So there's a number of fact sheets that would be, and by the way, Mary, if you could kind of go through, we kind of flip through different visuals from that document there. So another useful thing that's in the document is a summary of some of the software that executes some of these methods for you and kind of qualitatively summarizes the ease of use, sophistication, basically, of the tool and its relative cost. In some cases, they're free. So there's a good information there. If you go on to the next one, another tool is the Project Manager's Toolbox. It has a number of links. For those of you who filled out on the poll question that you're a project manager involved in this kind of stuff, this would be the place to go to have fast access to a number of tools, including those fact sheets, but a number of other links to other useful topics there. Another one to highlight is a review checklist. So if you indicated that you were a reviewer of the output of these geospatial methods and analysis, this would be something handy for you to kind of have at your side as you go through and review this, just to make sure that the methodology and documentation is adequate. That would be helpful. And then lastly, if we could go to the next one, the document has a number of flowcharts that help you in whatever role, including practitioner, how to approach the problem. And so I've got another example. You may see others as we go along, but there's one kind of shown here. So it helps walk you through everything. It's not just text, which is really handy to have these flowcharts. Let's go now to slide 15. Just to kind of end this introductory discussion, I wanted to give you an idea of what our objective is with this training today. We're trying to get across to the kind of folks that are on the call that you indicated in the poll. We want you to be able to understand the applicability of the methods. You should be able to determine if it's going to be appropriate to apply these geospatial methods. We want you to be able to identify optimization-related questions that can be asked at different lifecycle phases where you can then apply geospatial methods to answer those questions. We want you to have some background on selecting the appropriate geospatial methods to answer those questions, and then we want you to be able to be in a better position to explain or apply those results so that you understand what they would probably mean. I do want to emphasize that, you know, in a 2 hours or a little over training, we can't convey all the detail that's present in the guidance document itself. We want you to get a taste. We want you to get some of the important concepts. We can go to slide 16 now. We're back to, again, another milepost slide here, and now we're transitioning into the second topic, which is kind of an overview of the opportunities to apply these different analysis methods. And so we're going to kind of set the stage for some of the more detailed discussions to come. If we could go to slide 17. Kind of a good framework to keep in mind as listening to the rest of the presentation today is that there is a distinct workflow for conducting geospatial analysis, and the bullets shown here kind of lay that out. Certainly it's good, no matter what you're doing on a project, it's good to review the conceptual site model, you know, your mental image and how the site is actually working, sources, pathways, processes that affect distribution, exposure points, all those kind of things, as well as reviewing the project goals. That's always good to start with that. Next step would be to become familiar with the data that you have that would support the analysis. Do some initial, what are called exploratory data analysis, kind of looking at the statistics of the data, getting a sense of the range and the values, that kind of stuff. And then once that's completed, to identify the appropriate geospatial method based on your available data, and then to construct a geospatial model, and then to check that model as the basis of preparing some type of interpolation or whatever, average calculation or whatever. Make sure that that's appropriate, and then of course the last step would be to generate and evaluate the results, including any predictions based on the analysis. And an aspect of that that's important is to evaluate the uncertainty in any predictions or conclusions that you would draw from that. Now, there are a number of flowcharts that will help, particularly with the middle three bullets here. And again, you see the blue underline there. There's an active link to take you to those flowcharts. And then the review checklist is going to be something that you could also maybe take a look at while generating and writing up the results of the analysis and evaluating that. Let's go to slide 18. I know this is a picture of multiple flowcharts that are very small, but I just wanted to give you an indication of the level of detail that these flowcharts have. They really are going to be a good guide through the process presented to multiple sheets with a lot of different questions to help get you down the right path. Let's go to slide 19. So let's talk now about the applications of these geospatial methods and some key considerations here. First, we'll talk about data requirements for doing these. We'll talk a little bit about the barriers and concerns about the application of these methods that you may encounter. We'll talk about some of the misapplications to avoid when applying these methods. And then we'll talk about use of these methods to answer questions related to optimization. Again, that's the context that we're looking at for these topics. Let's go now to slide 20. So what are the data requirements to do geospatial analysis? Well, obviously with the word spatial in there, we have to have spatial coordinates for our data. So we need to have at least horizontal coordinates and in a lot of cases three-dimensional coordinates, including a depth. That's the kind of data that we're going to deal with. Obviously, we're going to need other information about the site, such as the hydrogeology, physical conditions, such as moisture content, maybe organic carbon content, of course, chemical concentrations, if we're interested in, anything related to characterization or design or whatever. Obviously, we're going to need other, constraints, logistical constraints, cleanup goals, those kind of things. So we're going to need those kind of bits of information. There is a flowchart that helps you identify what level of database you're going to need to do these kind of things. And it comes out with recommendations that are based on a categorization, qualitative categorization of the different methods. It's either simple, more complex, or advanced, and you'll hear more about those. And the data requirements for those different kinds of methods will vary. And this flow chart to the left will actually help you walk through that. Certainly, the amount of data depends on the method and your objective. So, hopefully you'll have that all in mind. Let's go now to slide 21. In many cases anymore, the geospatial analysis, including geostatistics, are pretty well understood and accepted, but it still happens that you're going to perhaps run into resistance or unfamiliarity and somewhat skepticism about the methods. There are a lot of state and federal agencies that have, actually embraced these geospatial methods and have policies related to them. But it's always good to check with the regulatory agencies that you're involved with to see how familiar they are and how readily accepting they are of these different kinds of methods. Certainly from the optimization point of view, the changes to the pathway for the project, the optimization changes, may be difficult to implement. There may be, specific documentation and process to go through to implement those. That may be difficult, but hopefully the geospatial aspects are something that will be accepted. If there's any hesitancy to accept that, it's often due to an unfamiliarity, and that's exactly why ITRC has put the effort into putting this document together, is to increase awareness and to help acceptance of these different technologies or different methods. It's a good time for another poll question, and I think, Mary, that this might have been up maybe before the presentation started. Have you ever experienced any resistance to using a geospatial method for a cleanup project? And again,
yeah,
I can't.
And those responding, about 30% say they have, and just scrolling through the answers on if their answer was yes, what their explanation was. Several have said cost considerations for getting people the necessary training. It's kind of easier to do what you've always done. People don't really understand, or nor do they want to learn something new. They don't really see the value in doing that. So kind of, you know, a lot of the things that you were talking about up above.
Yep. Okay. Sounds very, very similar to what we've had in past presentations as well. So anyway, thank you for that kind of feedback. Let's go ahead and go on to slide 22. Just a little discussion about some of the common misapplications, and there is more information about common misapplications associated with the guidance document. But some of the common misapplications, maybe doing the analysis with an inadequate amount of data, just not enough, extrapolating the data beyond their spatial or temporal limits, where you really don't have the constraints. Some of the geospatial models may not take into account some of the, say, geologic or hydrogeologic heterogeneity that we may know about as professionals. It's just can't deal with that. Other issues related to having non-detects sensor data in general, some of the methods may not adequately account for the uncertainty either in the data or in the output. And as an example of the importance of understanding the heterogeneities and geologic features of the site, the figure to the right there shows a piezometric contour map that has been drawn based on available data where a fault actually crosses the site. If that fault is actually a barrier to flow, which it can be in different parts of the country, then you may not draw the contours continuing across that fault in the way that it's shown here and the way that the geospatial algorithm actually drew them, not knowing the impact of that particular fault. The contours may be much different on either side of the fault rather than continuing through them. So that's just an example, and you'll hear about others as well. Let's go now to slide 23. I mentioned that one of the things we wanted to help people with was to ask the right optimization questions at different life cycle phases for their projects, and then to highlight how geospatial methods can help answer those questions so you can better optimize your project at that phase. And so we actually looked at five different phases in the life cycle, everything from evaluating if a release has occurred all the way to site closure. And there's a whole bunch of different questions that we have in the document. I've picked out just example ones that I'm not going to read here, but that you can see just to kind of get a sense for the kind of questions that we ask. And, you know, so that for each of those questions, then we will offer some geospatial methods that can help answer those kind of questions. So let's go to slide 24 as an example of this. And so we're looking at, let's say, the site characterization phase. And the question that we want to consider related to optimization is, what would be the appropriate sample spacing at the site considering what's called spatial correlation? In other words, intuitively, I think most of people would understand that if you took a sample at one location and then took another sample very close by, that you would expect those values, that concentration of whatever contaminant or other property, would be very similar. That you know, just because you're not far apart. But as you increase the spacing between that original sample and the other sample, you could see where the difference could become much larger depending on the nature of the site. And actually, some of the methods take into consideration that relationship of sample spacing and the variability or differences between those values. So that's what I mean by spatial correlation. So if we understand that spatial correlation, it can help us plan a sample spacing such that we don't duplicate information, yet still have an adequate density to support our decisions. So in this case, we're trying to characterize soil contamination. We can use a geospatial analysis to, you know, estimate the spacing that avoids that duplication. We can do that using a geostatistical approach called variogram construction. You'll hear more about that, and get what's called a geostatistical range and use that or some fraction of that as a basis for your sample spacing. And there's software that would help do that, and those software packages are identified in the guide. So that's just an example of how we kind of cascade from phase to question to method to tools to use. Let's go to slide 25. So where do we go from here? Well, we're going to talk more about actually answering those questions. And so just to reiterate that we have categorized different methods as simple, more complex, or advanced. You're going to hear more about those. And different ones help answer different questions. And again, we have software tools identified that can help with that. So let's go to slide 26. This is another poll question, and I just kind of want to gauge, you know, how good of a sales job I've done here. Based on what's been presented so far, do you think that the sites that you're working on could benefit from geospatial analysis? And again, Mary, if you could indicate, you know, how
what we're seeing is over 80% are saying yes. A couple people are saying no, not enough data, and a few are saying don't know yet. But certainly the large majority are saying yes at this point.
Okay. Well, we've got some other instructors who hopefully will bring everybody into the yes category here. So if we go now to slide 27, we're back to a milepost marker, and my pleasure to turn this over to Adam Jansen with Barr Engineering in Minneapolis.
All righty, thanks, Dave. So our goals for this fundamental section are to give you kind of a high-level overview of how geospatial methods work so that you can understand kind of what's going on underneath the hood in the software and, you know, be careful not to misapply the software and the methods. Now, there are a lot of details with this that we can't get into in the next 20 minutes, but there are a lot of that information is in the guidance document for you to refer to later. So Tobler's first law of geography here on this slide sums up the basic premise of geospatial methods pretty well, which is that, you know, information collected from locations close to each other tends to be more similar than collected from information from locations far apart. So, for example, if you were to go out and collect a couple of samples at, you know, two very nearby locations, you might expect those sample results to be pretty similar, whereas you wouldn't expect that if you collected them from two locations that were pretty far apart. So this relationship between similarity and proximity is called spatial correlation. And if we have spatial correlation present in our data set, we can try to quantify it using geospatial methods. And then that'll help us understand what might be going on in between our data points where we don't actually have any information. And then being able to understand that can help us to optimize our sample collection and spacing so that we're not collecting redundant information. But what does spatial correlation look like? So we have three cases here as examples. On the far left, we have an example of a data set that does not have any spatial correlation. So this is whatever hypothetical property here we're symbolizing by different colors and symbol sizes appears to be kind of randomly distributed in space. So this is an example of a data set where we really couldn't do anything with geospatial methods. But contrast that with the other two cases here where clearly we have some pattern in the data. In the middle here, we have what's known as a trend. It's a large-scale systematic variation. So it's very easy to imagine drawing some contours on this map, kind of following the color separations. Now, an example of what we might be looking at here are, say, like hydraulic heads measured at monitoring wells. You know, kind of like a one-dimensional groundwater flow field here towards the lower left corner of the image. The third case that we're looking at here is what's called the autocorrelation. So autocorrelation meaning that the variable is correlated with itself in space. And we kind of have like clumps of similar values here. So an example of what we might be looking at, say, are concentrations of some contaminant in the subsurface at like a former industrial site. We put these black bars on here to indicate kind of the apparent scale of the spatial correlation. And that's a very important concept that we're going to come back to here in a few slides. I'll note that the trend in the autocorrelation cases here are not mutually exclusive. Often our data sets will show some combination of both of those. So to try to illustrate that a little bit further, imagine here we have a very high resolution data set, which is this black line, like we're looking at a kind of a slice through it. And while we see there's a lot of variability in this black line, there does appear to be kind of this larger scale overarching pattern to it that we've traced with the blue line. And so if we were trying to decompose this data set into the trend and autocorrelation components for modeling, we would use the trend here would be the blue line, and then the autocorrelation component is then the deviation from that blue line in the black line. So while we're talking about geospatial modeling, you see a geospatial model can include up to three components here. We've already talked about the trend and the autocorrelation, and the third component is an error model to account for error in our measurements. And as Dave alluded to in the introduction, the ITRC guidance document groups together geospatial methods into three categories: simple, more complex, and advanced. And those categories are based on which components of a geospatial model you could model with any of these methods. So the trend, you can model with any of the different classes, the simple, the more complex, or advanced. But if we want to include an error model in our geospatial model, that limits us to using the more complex or advanced methods. And then what kind of the definition of the advanced methods, what really sets them apart, is that they include this explicit model of the autocorrelation. So here on this slide, we're looking at where different methods fall on this category scheme. So the simple methods are a number of different kind of basic interpolation techniques, things like natural neighbor interpolation and Voronoi diagrams or so on, that'll help you basically connect the dots in multiple dimensions between your data points. The more complex methods are many different types of regressions that give you, more of a best fit surface to your data. And then the advanced methods are what you may have heard called the geostatistical methods. And so the base method is called Kriging, and there are a lot of different types of Kriging that have been developed for different applications. And so then these include that explicit autocorrelation model. So because we've classified these different methods by basically their capabilities, it follows that some of them may be appropriate for certain tasks, more appropriate for certain tasks than others. So the simple methods are good for making maps. So if all you're interested in doing is taking a point data set and then either interpolating it to a continuous surface to show as a color map or to draw contours from, the simple methods often work really well for things like that. So also make sure to evaluate your model against your conceptual site model or CSM to make sure that the results you get make sense. But the simple methods will help you interpolate values between your data points, but they can't give you any idea of the level of uncertainty associated with those estimates. And if we're trying to do optimization, we kind of need to know that. And so that's where the more complex or advanced methods come in, because those are based on some underlying statistical modeling that allows you not just to interpolate a value, but also give some idea of what level of certainty is associated with it. One little note that we want to point out here, there's no reason you can't use the more complex or advanced methods just to make maps, like in place of the simple methods. And certain software packages make that really easy. Surfer is a great example. I can load a point data set into Surfer and generate a contour map using Kriging in minutes and not have to do any statistical modeling. But that's made possible by there being a default autocorrelation model in Surfer. And so we just want to make sure that that if you want to actually do optimization and you need to put some stock into those uncertainty numbers, be sure that you've actually done the statistical modeling that those are based on and not just rely on any default parameters in the software. So to sum up a little bit where we've gotten to this point, if we have spatial correlation in our data set, that allows us to use geospatial methods in the first place. But because the samples are correlated in space, if we want to add more data to our data set, simply adding more points isn't necessarily going to give us more information, because it not only matters how many points you have, but also how they're located relative to one another. And in particular, the risk here is that you're going to space points too close together and collect duplicate or redundant information. So to try to avoid doing that, we need to understand what the scale of the spatial correlation is. And we can do that using something called the variogram. So the variogram is basically a plot of variability on the vertical axis versus spacing between pairs of points on the horizontal axis. If you're using Kriging, the variogram is that autocorrelation model used by the advanced methods. But even if we're not using those, we can still make a variogram to try to get at that scale of spatial correlation. So here we have kind of a generic and a classical variogram to look at. You see we have variability, a quantity called the semivariance on the y-axis, and then point spacing, sometimes called the lag, distance between pairs of points on the x-axis. These individual dots that are on this figure are what are known as the experimental or empirical variogram. So these are not your actual data points, but they're generated from a lot of number crunching of unique pairs of data in your data set. And the guidance document explains kind of exactly how that's done. But once you get the experimental variogram, then we fit a theoretical variogram model to it here, which is this solid red line. And in the next section, Chris is going to talk about how we go about doing that. But thinking back to that basic premise of geospatial methods, you know, we see that this variogram reflects that where our points are close together, our variability is low. But as we keep getting points spaced farther and farther apart, our variability keeps increasing, but kind of only up until a certain distance here at which the variability starts to level off. And so this kind of magic distance here is called the range of the variogram, or the scale of spatial correlation. Another important feature here on the variogram is this value of variability that it levels off to, which is called the SIL of the variogram. And theoretically, this is equivalent to the population variance. And one more feature in the variogram is called the nugget, which is the y-intercept of the variogram model. On this variogram, it's zero. The nugget is where you would incorporate an error model into the variogram, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit. One thing we have to keep in mind when making variograms is that directionality can matter and be very important. So like we're trying to, we generate this variogram by looking at differences between values at pairs of points. And so it might matter, you know, which direction, how the points are oriented relative to one another. A great example would just be points at different XY locations versus points that are at the same XY location in different depths. And so like being able to take that directionality into account is something that we talk more about in the guidance document, but especially for 3D problems is something you need to keep in mind. So let's go back to those three different cases of spatial correlation and show you what a variogram would look like for each of them. For the case where we have no spatial correlation, we just get a horizontal line for our variogram. For the case of the trend, we get an unbounded variogram that does not reach a sill. It just keeps increasing and increasing off to infinity. And the reason for that is that, you know, as you're looking at differences between pairs of samples, if you're looking at pairs of points that are kind of along this diagonal axis here, the farther and farther apart you look, the more and more different the points keep getting, which is why this never levels off. Finally, the autocorrelation case gives us a variogram that looks like the one we just saw on the previous slide, where there's a definite relationship between the values and the distance between points at distances smaller than these black lines, which are the range of the variogram. But then once you get outside of that, the picture starts to look a lot more like the no spatial correlation case, and then you get the horizontal line component to it. And at this point, I think it's a good idea to take a pop quiz. So this is the same variogram we saw a couple slides ago, but this time we have numbers on the axes. And so we want to know what are the range and the SIL of this variogram. So to try to be efficient with time here, as you're taking some time to answer this, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the nugget of the variogram. So recall that the nugget is the y-intercept of the fitted model, and this is where we incorporate an error model into this. So if the nugget is zero, like it is for this variogram, that's saying that if we went out and we collected two samples at exactly the same location, we should get exactly the same result. So there's no error in our measurements. So that's often an assumption that we can make, but in the real world, it's not completely true. We know that there's error in our measurements. A good example of that would be analysis of duplicate water quality samples. So we have two samples taken at pretty much the same time from exactly the same location, and then they often come back different, indicating that there's error in our lab methods. So if you have some data like that, to try to quantify an error in your measurements or your numbers, you can use that as a guide for helping you to choose an appropriate value for the nugget in your variogram so that you can incorporate that error into the analysis. So the rate of responses here is slowing down, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. And then we will reveal the answer here, which it looks like pretty much everybody got. And the C, the range of this variogram is 24, and the SIL is 9. So the SIL, remember, is theoretically the variance of the population. That's that value the variability levels off to. And then the range is that scale of spatial correlation that has implications for sample spacing. So an example of what we mean by that or how we would use it, we're going to look at one of the case studies from the guidance document. And so this is a site where there's sediment that's been contaminated by PCBs. And the authors of this study went out over a 7-year period and collected 749 samples of this sediment, analyzed them for PCBs, and then used that information to delineate the area of sediment that had concentrations above the risk-based threshold that then they were going to have to remediate. But after they did this, they looked back and said, wow, 749 is a lot of samples. Did we really need that many, or could we have gotten basically the same delineation with a smaller number of points? So they did a retrospective kind of geospatial analysis looking back to see whether, you know, that might have, you know, had some savings associated with it. So what they found was after the first 2 years of sampling, they collected 240 samples, you know, with decent coverage over the site, so they knew something. And then they could generate a variogram using those 240 samples, and they found that it had a range of about 400 feet. So if they had known that back in 2002, and use that as a guide. So like say, let's not put any new points within 400 feet or so of any points that we already have. They found that they really only needed 24 more data points to get basically the same delineation that they got from the full data set. So we can assume that, you know, they could have been done probably in one more year. They could have collected the next 24 points and, you know, been done in 2003 when in real life they went out over 5 more years and collected another 509 samples, most of which probably it seemed was redundant or not giving them much additional information. So this is a pretty dramatic example, but just showing that once you have some information about the site, you know, if you can start applying geospatial methods, you know, that really can provide a lot of value to the project to avoid unnecessary data collection. So on this slide, we're going to look at 6 different contour maps that were all generated from the same data set, but using different geospatial methods to try to highlight some of the similarities and differences between them. And so we'll start off with a couple of simple methods, so triangulation and natural neighbor. Give us pretty similar-looking maps, but one thing you notice right away with these is that they don't fill the entire rectangle here. The extents of the contours are limited to kind of a convex hull of the data. So that's by definition, these methods can only interpolate. They can't extrapolate. And so something that you should keep in mind. Moving on to another simple method, inverse distance to a power, also known as inverse distance weighting. This works differently from the first two here. It looks for computes values at unsampled locations using a weighted sum of nearby data points. And then those weights are just based on an inverse distance, inverse power function of the distance between points. So as you can see from this example, this method has a tendency to produce bullseyes in a contour map, which may or may not be desirable. For some applications, it's okay, but I'd caution you, especially for groundwater elevation contour maps, be very careful using this method because, you know, in a groundwater elevation map, if you see closed contours, that's an indication of like a source or sink to groundwater, so a pumping well or an injection well, and you may be getting closed contours if you use inverse distance weighting at locations where there, you know, there isn't pumping or injecting going on, and so just be very careful using this method for kind of all applications to be sure that the results you get seem consistent with your conceptual site model. Moving on to a more complex method, the local polynomial regression gives us a much smoother surface than anything we've seen from the simple methods, and that's because this isn't bound to honor every data point exactly the way the simple methods are. So we get more of this smoother kind of best fit surface to the data. And I'll talk more about the implications of that in a couple of slides, you know, whether or not that's a good thing. Radial basis functions here are another more complex method, but you see they do a much better job of locally matching the data points, and you get a very similar map to what you get from Krieging, the advanced method. Krieging is like inverse distance weighting in that it uses a weighted sum of nearby data points to interpolate values, but it's a lot more sophisticated with how it chooses the weights. It uses the variogram, and then by doing that, it gives you something that avoids the bullseyes that you would get with inverse distance weighting. But now that we have all 6 up here on the screen at once and you can see, you know, how similar and different they are, you know, don't be alarmed that we didn't get exactly the same thing from all of these, even though we used the same data set. Just because the methods work differently, they're based on different assumptions. But obvious question is, well, which one should I use? And as Dave mentioned in the first section, there are some very comprehensive flow charts in the guidance document that will help guide you through that process. You know, taking into account factors like how much data you have. So, you know, do you have enough data to really use Krieging effectively? Or, you know, also just like what question are you trying to answer? And that'll help guide you as to what the most appropriate method is to use for your particular situation. So as I said, creating an inverse distance weighting are using weighted sums of nearby data points. So in the software, you have to define what counts as a nearby data point. And the parameter that does that is called the search neighborhood radius. So as an example here, you know, we're going to interpolate a value at the center of this circle using all the points that are within the circle. And so this circle here then is the search neighborhood. So typically, you want to set the search radius kind of as small as you can to try to, you know, not smear out variability in your data set. But if you ever come up with a map that looks like the one on the lower left here, where you have really sharp transitions between colors, or if this were a contour map, you'd have some really jagged-looking contours, it's almost always an indication that your search radius is too small. And so you can eliminate these sharp transitions and really smooth out the map simply by increasing the value of the search neighborhood radius like I did here. So exact interpolation is another way of saying that the interpolation method honors your data. So everywhere you have a data point, the method had better return that exact value at that location. So by definition, the simple methods have to be exact interpolators. The more complex methods generally aren't, and then Kriging can go either way. It can be an exact interpolator and match every point exactly. If you use a zero nugget in the varigram, so remember that was the y-intercept, so you're saying no error in the measurements, you know, it'll nail everything exactly. Or Kriging can also be an inexact interpolator. So if you have a non-zero nugget in your variogram, Kriging is no longer bound to exactly honor all of your points. And so that's, we have an example here of that being done. So both of these contour maps were generated from the same data set using Kriging. Just the upper map here, we used a zero nugget, so we have exactly matched all the data points. Whereas on the lower map, we used a non-zero nugget, and so we get a much smoother map. But if we zoom in on this lower one, you're going to see things like a couple of 170 points here that are between the 170 and 165 contour. We have a 149 here that's between 150 and 155. You know, it's easy to look at this map and see things like this and then conclude that the map has to be wrong. And so for that reason, often we can't use exact interpolation because the people looking at it are going to perceive that we did something wrong or we don't know what we're doing. But I think there are definitely cases where if you know that there's significant error in your measurements, you can make a case that using the inexact interpolation here is actually more appropriate than making a contour map like the one above, where you have some really sharp turns and bends in these contours trying to exactly match all the data points. And you're like, well, should you really be doing that when you know that some of these numbers are kind of way off to begin with? And so this is just a case of using professional judgment, you know, and knowing your audience and like how the map will be perceived and how you're likely to be most successful in conveying the message. So geospatial models are no different than any model. They're only as good as the information that you put into them. And so like, if you're omitting anything that's very significant, you can come up with results that would cause you to miss something or draw an inappropriate conclusion. So the example that we have here is that we have this shallow alluvial aquifer that's hydraulically connected to the big river. And this aquifer is known to be discharging to the river here. This is a gaining stream. We've discovered some contamination in this aquifer at monitoring well 1, and then we installed this pumping well over here, PW1, to capture it. So after the system was operational, we went out and measured groundwater elevations at several other locations, all the black dots here, then generated a contour map. And then once we had that, we inferred a downgradient flow direction here from MW1, and sure enough, it goes straight to the pumping well, so we conclude that our system is working as expected. But if we look a little more carefully at this figure, there are some things that are wrong with it compared to our conceptual site model. So first off, we have contours that are perpendicular to the river. And so we think that this aquifer is discharging groundwater to the river. You know, contours perpendicular to it would indicate no flow between the aquifer and the river. So that's an inconsistency with our conceptual site model. And another thing we notice here is that we have an awful lot of closed contours in this contour map, even though only one of these wells, PW1, is pumping. And that's an artifact of using inverse distance weighting to generate these contours, that we get some of these bullseyes at, you know, wells that are not pumping. So if we fix both of these things, you know, let's use Kriging instead of inverse distance weighting, and let's take the elevation of the river into account in our data set. If we do that, we get a different looking contour map here that's more consistent with our conceptual site model, but if we do the same analysis of the downgradient flow path, you know, now it goes straight to the river instead of going to the pumping well, so we get a different conclusion. So just a warning here that, you know, make sure that anything that's important to the system gets included in the analysis to be sure that you draw an appropriate conclusion from the results. So that wraps up the fundamental section. Just hit a couple of the high points here. We have to have spatial correlation in our data set in order to be able to use geospatial methods, so something to check for right from the start. Our geospatial model can include up to three components, the trend, the error model, and the autocorrelation, and then which components we include kind of depend on what we see in the data and what questions we're trying to answer. We can use variograms to quantify spatial correlation, and so that can be very helpful to make sure that we understand what the scale of the spatial correlation is, so that we don't space points too close together and collect redundant information. And then finally, you know, always be careful to make sure that we're honoring our conceptual site model with whatever method we choose, and be sure that the results are consistent. So we're going to go to a question and answer break right now, but then after that, Chris Stubbs from Ramboll is going to go through some step-by-step examples of applications.
Thanks, Adam. We do now have time for questions and answers. For those of you on the phone line, in just a moment, I'll give you a chance to ask your questions out loud if you would like to do so. And it is *6 to unmute your phone. For those of you that would like to type your question in, please do so in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. And those will come in, and we'll get to as many of those to respond to verbally as we can. Otherwise, we'll try to respond back to those directly in writing. I'm going to go ahead and pull up a poll question for you to answer while we're in our question and answer session. So if you'd take a few minutes to complete that. If you can't quite see all the choices, again, there should be scroll bars either on the bottom or the right-hand side for you to access all of the choices. Just a reminder for those of you who do need documentation of continuing education, we ask that you fill out the online feedback form. Once you complete the online feedback form, in the bottom of that form, there's a box for you to click on to certify you participated today. Once you click that box and then press submit, a certificate of participation will be generated for you. If you forget to click the box, just go ahead and go back, fill out the feedback form again, and click that box, and that's the way that you will get your certificate. Are there any questions from our phone lines? If so, please go ahead and speak up now and ask your question to the trainers. All right, we'll go ahead and go to some written questions. This first question refers to slide number 9, so I've went ahead and brought that slide up on the screen. And it's the one on why this matters, geospatial tools optimize our work. And the question says, in slide 9, given that both the top panels are Krieg data, wouldn't it be possible that rather than being an indication that the 30 points were unnecessary to defining the concentration term accurately, that instead the quality of the Krieging code was such that, for good or for bad, that it was unaffected by the presence or absence of these points? That may be a long-winded way to ask the question, if it isn't important to include some kind of characterization of ground truth on the Krieging estimates in any application.
Okay, well, let's stay back here. I guess I'll take a crack at it. If somebody else wants to weigh in, that'd be great too. In terms of, you know, the actual truth, the map that's prepared with all the data points, you know, is basically the baseline that we compare any subsequent map with removed data or based on data that excludes certain monitoring points or sampling locations. If, you know, regardless if it's Krieging or, you know, any of the other interpolation type techniques, if that maps looks pretty much the same without those data points, then those data points really weren't contributing incrementally a whole lot of information to, you know, make that map if that's our primary goal. And so I guess that, you know, it's not a matter of whether or not the Krieging routine was good, you know, or you know, very robust or something like that. I mean, any of these methods are making some type of determination, you know, as Adam talked about, you know, within a search radius or whatever with the data they have. And if comes up with the same number with or without some of those data points, then, you know, it does make you wonder if those data points, looking at strictly from that point of view, are really necessary. Maybe, you know, they may be necessary for other reasons. You know, maybe for this contaminant it wasn't, but for other contaminants they are. You know, obviously there's other considerations that would come into play there. But, you know, I'm not sure that it's a matter of the efficiency of the algorithm or robustness of the algorithm. Adam or Chris, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I'll add that, you know, there are a number of techniques for trying to evaluate how robust the creaking model is. Like one of the most common ones is called cross-validation. Like Chris will talk about that in the next section about how that's done. You know, something you could do with, you know, this particular example on slide 9 is, you know, you have those 30 locations that weren't used, but you know what the values are at those. You know, you can compare what you got from creaking when you didn't use them to the actual values, and, you know, you can see how well or not well the creaking is doing at those locations specifically. You know, you kind of get an idea that it's doing pretty well based on the kind of the bottom map there, where the differences are all really small. You know, other than going out and collecting more data, you know, usually we use all the points that we have to generate the interpolations. You know, we don't leave some out, but, you know, you could try to experiment with only using some of them and then seeing how the creaking results compare to the locations you didn't use in the interpolation.
All right, we'll move on to another question. It says, with regards to 3D interpolation, is there a plan to follow up to discuss implications of things like anisotropy?
Yeah, anisotropy was something that, you know, we just didn't really have time to get to in the kind of this introductory section, but it's something that's discussed a lot more in the guidance document, because on a three-dimensional interpolation, that is pretty important to be sure that you're accounting for kind of variability that's related to points being at different XY locations versus variability that's related to points being at different depths, you know, because of the way that things tend to be in layered systems. And so that is an important topic. It's just it's, there's a lot of detail to it that we just didn't have time to get to.
Okay, the next question says, it was not clear to me how to create a variogram to optimize a monitoring network. Is there software to create this?
Yep, so most software packages that do geospatial analysis or geostatistics, you know, will, you know, be able to generate a variogram. So things like Surfer or ArcGIS or SGEMS, there's many other ones that we talk about in the guidance document. But as far as then how to use it to optimize it, you know, that there are more than one way to skin the cat with that. We talked about kind of a simple approach in the fundamental section, where you just generate the variogram to get a scale of spatial correlation and then use that as a guide for spacing points. But then there also are things that are more complicated. There are software packages, things like Visual Sample Plan, which is what we just saw on that slide 9, the example that Dave showed. There's another one called the Summit Enviro Solutions software, the sample optimizer, I think it is, that try to follow algorithms of, you know, being able to take points out and then add points in, like compare, you know, how much difference there was, whether you did or didn't use certain points, and then try to conclude which ones may or may not be necessary. And I, you know, some of those, I think Visual Sample Plan also may help you try to design a sampling network kind of from the beginning, although I'm not as familiar with that software. So I'd encourage you to look at the kind of the software section of our guidance document, because we do lay out some of the different capabilities of the different programs, you know, and like some of them are specifically designed to try to help you optimize the network.
We also had a comment coming in and said they're wondering if we're missing some of the open source GIS tools, or perhaps maybe it's discussed more in the document, and then they refer to QGIS or SCADA.
Yeah, it's certainly very possible that we're missing some from the list. You know, this document was published in 2016, so anything newer than that, you know, we definitely wouldn't have included. But, you know, some of them, yeah, we may just be guilty of omission, like things that we weren't as familiar with or just didn't know about.
All right, well, thanks for those questions, and trainers, for providing those answers. We are going to go ahead and move into the second portion of our training. So please continue to submit those questions in the Q&A pod. Thank you for filling out the poll. It looks like many of you are already considering or have used geospatial methods for performing optimization at your projects. So we encourage you, if you haven't, be sure to look at the ITRC guidance document. As the trainer said, there's so much information in that guidance document, and we just can't get to all of it in the short training class that we have today. So let's go ahead now and move on to slide number 48, and I will turn it over to Chris Stubbs with Ramball. Chris?
Okay, thanks very much. So in this next section, we'll go through some examples and kind of try and illustrate some of these points we've been making. And here's the outline. In the process of going through the examples, we'll also talk about some of these issues here I've listed. A little bit more about what we mean about modeling data and the benefits of that. We'll talk about a geospatial analysis workflow, which can be quite useful to follow. How to quantify uncertainty, and that's in the sort of first third, and then we'll go over an example of how to use one of the more complex methods. Talk about exploratory data analysis, and then finally we'll talk about an example of how to use some of the advanced methods. And as part of that, we'll talk about how to do model evaluation, and this is the example we'll do talk about is using cross-validation, which Adam mentioned briefly. Okay, so when we're trying to optimize, you know, do an optimization, generally speaking, we have to use these more complex or advanced methods because we want to actually model the data, meaning kind of customize our approach to the actual site that we have, the site-specific conditions. And so that's what I'm kind of referring to when I say modeling the data. And then once we do that, then we can get more accurate predictions at unsampled locations. And then perhaps more importantly, we're able to estimate the uncertainty in those predictions. And that's something you really can't do with the sort of simple methods, or, you know, even if you just, you know, open up your software and use Kriging or something fancy, if you haven't really thought about how well that model is, you know, customized to your situation, then the estimates of uncertainty won't be that good. And as we said, we can also optimize the sampling plan. So the simplest way, this is one of the questions someone just asked, you know, it's how do you use the Variagram to do that? I mean, the simplest way is you can just look at the Variagram, which gives you an evaluation of how close your data have to be to each other to be correlated. So, you know, that kind of gives you a sense of sample spacing, because if you have them really close, then they'll be very correlated and they're kind of redundant. So if you're kind of on the edge of that range of correlation, that's where you're going to get the most bang for your buck for your sampling. So that's kind of one example of how you can optimize them. All right, so let's keep going here. All right, so there is a very nice geospatial workflow that's laid out in the online guidance, and this can be useful for both practitioners who are actually doing the geospatial analysis, but also reviewers that are reviewing someone else's work. You know, it's nice to follow this workflow, kind of go step by step, kind of helps you, you know, make sure you're doing a good analysis, and kind of reminds you to document each step of the workflow. It's going to help out those reviewers that are trying to understand what you did. So we'll see a little bit more about this geospatial workflow. So here's the five steps of the workflow. The first one I think everyone's probably familiar with, just reviewing that conceptual site model. You know, what are the key site features that need to be represented in your analysis? And then also reviewing the project goals, figuring out what questions you need to answer. So to start off with, we recommend performing exploratory data analysis. It's just like plotting up the data in different ways. You can evaluate the distribution, the outliers, trends, Since this is about geospatial data, generally we want to look at geospatial correlation. You usually do that with the variogram. And also consider other auxiliary data that may be useful. Next, you'll pick a geospatial method. And in this guidance, we've sort of divided the methods into these three categories of simple, more complex, and advanced. And we're going to talk more about the more complex and advanced in this section, but depending on your goals, a simple method might also be appropriate. So after you pick the method, then you sort of build the model or run the model, and an important step here is to check the model to make sure that your predictions are actually accurate, and in particular that whatever you get out of that analysis is consistent with the conceptual site model. All right, then finally you look at your results and the uncertainty and use them in the analysis. All right, so just a quick reminder here about how we measure uncertainty in statistics. So generally we use something called the standard error, or it's also referred to as the variance, which is just the square of the standard error. So those are basically things that are kind of measuring the same thing. The more complex and advanced methods all give you an output of either standard error or variance. And that's what we use to assess the uncertainty in the predictions. Those can be interpreted in different ways. The most common maybe is to construct confidence or prediction intervals, which are based on those standard errors. But another way you can do it when you're doing maps is you can map out an exceedance probability, which shows, in a spatial way, the probability that the concentration, for example, at a particular place might exceed a threshold that's of interest. So that's another way of doing it. It's just a quick graphical illustration of what we're talking about here. So this is just like a 1D example of, for example, data along a transect. So the x-axis is the distance along the transect, and the y-axis is the concentration. So we start with the data, we fit a model to it, looks something like this. Then as part of that model, we'll look at the standard error, sort of how far off that model can be. And then we can convert that standard error to a confidence interval. So often we'll use a 95% confidence interval, so which is roughly two times the standard error usually. And so you can kind of see here that's the error bar on our estimate of from the model. So this is the kind of thing we'll do, but in two dimensions usually, sometimes in three. All right, so let's get started with this example. Dave kind of introduced the example before. We basically have shallow soil samples in a floodplain near this river, which is actually on the border between Belgium and the Netherlands. So there are a bunch of metals tested for, but we're just showing the zinc concentrations here. And as you may recall from Dave's description of it, you do notice a little a pattern in that the concentrations of zinc tend to be highest near the river that's kind of going there in the blue. So our conceptual site model might be that the flooding is spreading these elevated concentrations in the sediment on the floodplain. So that's our conceptual model of it, and let's go to thinking about what questions we might answer in this example. So, first of all, we'll try and estimate what the 95% upper confidence level, or UCL, of the mean is. And this is something we often have to do for risk assessment purposes, is look at this 95 UCL. And for this example, since it's related to using more complex methods, we're going to think about whether there's any secondary data, proxy data, other sources of data besides the zinc that we can use to improve our predictions of the zinc concentrations. Anyway, and this example is presented in more detail in the online guidance. So I'm going to cut out some of the details as I'm going through it, but if you want to look at all the gory details, consult the guidance. So in our workflow, geospatial workflow, next up is the exploratory data analysis. So we want to plot up the data. So here I've got an example of the zinc concentrations just plotted. in their raw form. So you see that the data distribution shown in this histogram is skewed. In other words, there's a lot more concentration of zinc there on the lower concentrations versus the higher. And usually we want to do, when we're doing statistical analysis, we like to see things more, you know, a little better bell-shaped curve of normally distributed things. So often for concentrations, we'll just log them. So if we log the zinc and then look at this histogram, we see, you know, much better symmetrical distribution. So that's usually the approach you want to take. You'll get better results from most of these methods. Okay, now here's the variogram. Now for these more complex methods, we don't model the variogram. We don't try and fit the variogram with the model, but we want to look at it. So here I've just shown the dots of the variogram. You can see that, you know, the approximate range of autocorrelation is around 800 meters. So beyond 800 meters, the data are not really related to each other. So if we were going to sample, design a sampling plan, you know, we'd want to have sample spacing less than 800 meters. Probably, you know, more in the, you know, 400, 600 range, something like that. All right, so we see that the zinc is autocorrelated. That is useful to know. And as we pointed out, or we assessed visually just from the initial plot, there is a relationship between the concentration of zinc and the distance from the river, which we're kind of showing here. So this is an example of some proxy or, you know, secondary data that we can use directly in our model to predict zinc. And we'll want to include as many of these types of secondary data as we can. That'll help make the model as good as it can be. So here's looking at another example. We have a map, a simple map of soil type. I haven't given them names. I've just called them, you know, 1, 2, and 3, and they're just colored on this map here. But if we summarize the concentrations of zinc in those three areas, we see on this shown on this box plot here that the concentrations in soil type 1, you know, tend to be higher for zinc than in soil types 2 or 3. So this is another kind of variable that we can include in the model, and this is referred to as categorical variable, because it only has a fixed, you know, number of categories. It's not, you know, continuously variable that we're looking at. So that is a good example. So now this is a description of the I'm just repeating the description of more complex methods that comes from the guidance document here. So I won't go through all these points, just hitting the highlights. So these more complex methods are sort of like regression methods. They do not include a spatial correlation model, so they don't include a variogram in them. You know, instead, we use other pieces of information that are available that can still account for that spatial correlation. The nice thing about the more complex methods, it can tend to be more flexible in some cases, so you can include other features like faults and rivers and things like that. And it really works best when you have the other predictor variables available. So in this case, we've got that distance from the river variable, and we got the soil type variable. So the assumptions of the model are that the, you know, after you've fit your model and you're looking at the residuals or what's, you know, left over as you, after you subtract the predictions from the original data, that those residuals aren't spatially autocorrelated and generally normally distributed. All right, so examples of these type of methods are regular parametric regression, which is probably the kind everyone's used to, and some kind of more flexible approaches that use splines and kernel smoothing, and those can be combined in a framework called non-parametric regression. So people probably haven't heard the term non-parametric regression, so here's a little illustration of what I mean by that. You know, with parametric regression, you have to pick a particular function that you're going to use, you know, like a quadratic function or something like that. So here's an example where we have a quadratic surface in this example of parametric regression. Well, you know, reality usually is not so simple. So We can instead use these nonparametric regression approaches that use splines and kernel smoothing and things like that to give us a more realistic surface. So that's kind of what we'll look at here, because we have that flexibility. All right, so we're going to, as I said, select nonparametric regression as our approach. We picked it basically because we have lots of nice secondary data to use. You know, listed here, we talked about the distance to the river and the soil time. We also have some other, like the flood frequency, that we can put in there as well. So we'll kind of go through, we should go through a little exercise where we try out all these different types of variables and kind of see which one works the best. And that's part of a model evaluation, which we'll talk a little bit more about in the next example. All right, so we do the nonparametric regression. This is what we get, predicted log zinc concentrations. Look pretty good. We see higher concentrations near the river. That's what we expect. We see some nice detail in there. And, of course, we also get estimates of standard error. So this is showing the uncertainty in those predictions. So, you know, we see, for example, more uncertainty down here, probably because there's less data that we collected down there. All right, now we want to check our assumptions. So if we take those model predictions and we subtract them from the original data, and then we look at the variogram of those residuals, we get a nice flat variogram, which means no autocorrelation. So our model is fulfilling that assumption that there's no spatial autocorrelation of the residuals. So we're good. We can go ahead and use this model. So as I said, we can use the model to look at the average concentration with confidence limits. That would kind of help us maybe for risk assessment or remediation purposes. And looking at the map of the uncertainties, the standard errors, you may point out areas where we want to take more samples to cut down that uncertainty. And then we can, you know, kind of play around with the model, because we can look at different sub-areas and target them for remediation, and then kind of see what we end up with after that happens. So once you have a model, you can use it for many different purposes, for planning and risk assessment and things like that. Okay, so let's look at this example again. But this time we'll use an advanced method. Everything's the same data, everything, the conceptual site model is exactly the same. We're just going to take a different approach. So because we're using an advanced method, which is going to use us an explicit model for spatial correlation, you know, we won't use the secondary data. We'll just use the zinc data and see how that works. We'll look at some, you know, similar questions, you know, what area might need remediation and where some should additional samples be located. So that's kind of similar. All right, so here's the summary from the guidance of the advanced methods. So like I said, the advanced methods are an extension of regression. Essentially, they include this extra model component that models the spatial correlation. So in order to do that, you have to have a lot of data available, because first of all, you have to estimate that variogram. You need enough data in order to get a good model of the variogram, and then you can use the data again to do the predictions. So the assumptions of these type of methods, which include kriging and its variance, are that the data are stationary, and all that means is that when you look around at different areas, that the statistical properties are the same from one area to the next. And of course that's necessary, because you're going to fit this statistical model and then we're going to apply it to the whole area. So obviously the statistical properties have to be similar, you know, throughout the area of interest. Again, we get prediction standard errors and variance, as we do with all the advanced methods. And there are many examples of these. And we'll talk a little bit about kriging and co-kriging, and also a bit about conditional simulation. All right, so when we use an advanced methods, we almost always have to come up with a variegram. So in other words, we have to fit a variegram model to our data. And you generally pick one of these standard variegram models, exponential, Gaussian, linear, Matern, power, spherical. Here's kind of their, kind of see they have different shapes and different characteristics. So for example, the linear one and the power one, they don't have a sill. They keep going higher and higher and higher. They're unbounded as you go to greater distances between your data. So here we're going to do a little quiz on this. So we have our data here, you know, which we looked at before, and what we want to do is pick which ones of these models would be an appropriate choice to fit this data. And there's more than one answer that could work. There's some that you should probably avoid, but just check all the ones that you think might work. And you basically want to look at two main places. You want to look at, you know, how the data is shaped near the origin or near the small distances, and also what happens as you go to bigger distances. Is it unbounded or bounded? You know, what's going on at those two areas? And make sure that you pick one of these models that's kind of consistent with that data. And that's kind of important. Usually, you know, more than one will work, and we'll look at, as we go further, you know, kind of the differences between how similar models perform. All right, so the results are still coming in, but it looks like a lot of people like the exponential model. They like the Gaussian, Matern, spherical is getting a little love too, but keep going there, so get your answers in. Okay, looks good. All right, so looks pretty good. I think everyone did pretty well on this. So basically what we see is that, you know, there's some that don't really work. So like the linear, you know, the power, you know, those wouldn't really be appropriate because they keep going up and up and up. They're unbounded. And we definitely see a sill in this data. So those would not be great choices. I think the other one we might throw out is the Gaussian. Quite a few people chose that, and you know it probably would work, but the reason I would throw it out is because you know near the origin here, you know, you kind of see this nice straight increase, and the Gaussian has a kind of a little you know curl there, which maybe doesn't fit quite as well. Otherwise, these ones would be fine, so everyone got that one pretty well. All right, so let's see what happens when we actually do it. So if we start with the exponential model, which is one of those ones, fitted to the data, we see pretty good fit. And generally, we don't care about the fit out here at the at distances beyond the range. So that doesn't matter that these points are down below that. We really want to look at close to the origin and out to the range. So here we get a pretty good fit. We see that the model does not go to zero semivariance, so that means this model has a nugget, which Adam talked about. So that means we're going to assume that there's a little bit of error in the data even at very close distances. So it doesn't have to fit exactly. It won't be an exact interpolator. All right, so just a reminder here for reviewers. You should ideally see a plot of the variegram in the documentation for a geospatial use of a geospatial method, because if you don't see a plot of it, then how can you know whether they picked a model that appropriately fits the data? So you should definitely look for that. Okay, so now before we get started, it's usually a good idea to detrend your data. So what I mean by that is if you have groundwater elevations, for example, like shown here, there's going to be a trend because there's the high water level and the low water levels, and you know that's going to determine which way the water's flowing. But there's an overall trend in the data, And the best thing to do is to try and remove that trend before you look at the variegram. If you don't and you just look at the variegram with the trend, you'll always get this sort of unbounded shape. So here I put every little individual point in the variegram clouds, all the little differences between all the points, but you can see the line where we fit the trend of it. So it's unbounded because there's a trend in this data. So the best thing is to do is to fit a trend surface to it and remove that trend and then do the variegram. All right, now if you've ever looked at some of the geospatial software that has kriging, you'll see there's a bunch of different choices about different varieties of kriging. I think they sort of have somewhat cryptic names, simple kriging, ordinary kriging, universal kriging, and so on, which are not too helpful, I think, in picking the appropriate one. But they basically all are similar in the sense that they all use the variegram that you've estimated. And then where they differ is what they've assumed for the trend in the data beyond that variegram. So as I said, ideally you will have removed the overall trend from the data, so you won't have much of a trend left. So what we recommend is that you just use ordinary kriging, which has no overall trend or just a constant value for the trend, but that it's unknown. And in reality, it can vary that sort of trend throughout the search neighborhood as it moves around the area of interest. So that's our recommendation, and usually that's going to work pretty well. All right, so if we use ordinary kriging with the spherical variegram, here's the estimated surface or the zinc concentrations. If we use the exponential variegram, here's the result. Now you can see it pretty much look the same. There's a few little areas where they may be different, but since both of those variegrams gave us a reasonable fit to the data, you get a similar result to it. So you don't have to stress too much on how you pick the variegram. But if you want to go and look at it quantitatively, which is a good idea, you can use the techniques of model evaluation. So model evaluation has different components to it. One of them is to evaluate the consistency of the predictions with the conceptual site model, which you should always do. You want to verify the assumptions of the method, which you should do. And then if you want to get into a more quantitative evaluation, you can use cross-validation. The kind of simplest way of doing cross-validation is called take-one-out cross-validation. And that's a sort of simple approach. You one by one go through each of your data points and you remove it from the data set. And then you use your method to predict the concentration, say, at that spot of the data that you removed. And you loop through and you go through every data point, you do that same thing. So you kind of get for every data point the model prediction, not considering that data point and the actual data point itself, and you can kind of compare those and see how your model's doing. The nice thing about cross-validation in this approach is you can use it with any method at all, including the simple methods, if you like. And it lets you look at both the accuracy of your predictions and also the accuracy of your standard errors, because if your model gives you an assessment of the uncertainty at each point, you can compare that to your cross-validation to see, whether the uncertainty really captured the error that you saw. All right, so I'll give a little example of what this might look like. So if we look at the two methods that we showed already, the ordinary kriging of the exponential variegram, the ordinary kriging with the spherical variegram, and for good measure, I've thrown in inverse distance weighting, which is a simple method. So here's the results of the cross-validation, where we've looped through, we've taken every point out one by one, and then we plot them. So on the x-axis is the actual data point. So this is like, for example, here at this point, we went out and measured there. You got something close to 6.75. But if you use the data besides that point and then predict it, for this case, the model came up with 5.5. So it didn't do that well. It's kind of really under-predicting. So we do it for all the things. So we see, basically the ideally this little blue line that kind of fit through all the cross-validation should be at a 45-degree angle like this. That would mean our model did really well. But basically, what we always see with these methods is that the model, that the cross-validation data is like a little flattened out. In other words, all these methods smooth out the data, meaning they underestimate at the higher end, and then they overestimate at the lower end. So they kind of smooth out the peaks, fill in the valleys. And that's just the effect of smoothing. So that's something to always keep in mind with these methods. They'll always kind of do that. All right, we can also look at those cross-validation, the results a little more quantitatively in sort of tables where we do summary statistics. So, for example, we can summarize them with the sort of mean error that we saw, or mean errors or root mean square errors, just different ways of summarizing all those errors. Then we can put them in a table and see, you know, how we really did. So, so if we look at the mean error, for example, we see, for example, the inverse distance weighting is a negative mean error, so that means it's kind of underestimating things overall. And it's kind of bigger number, bigger magnitude than these other methods. And this one, you know, I guess you'd say the spherical did the best job. It has the smallest magnitude of mean error. Root mean squared error is kind of gives similar results, but you don't have to worry about the pluses or minuses. You know, again, you see the ordinary Kriging ones do much better than the inverse distance weighting, as you might expect. Now, we can also look at the standard error, you know, just to kind of see how well the predictions, the estimate of the prediction uncertainty was. And we can't do that for the simple methods because they don't provide any estimate of uncertainty, so we can't do it for that. But for these methods, we can do it either using the mean or the root mean square. And you see, you know, maybe of these, you know, the spherical variogram with ordinary Kriging, you know, seems to do the best here. And for these root mean squares, we actually want them to be close to 1. So they're pretty similar. So that's kind of how you can look at things more quantitatively in terms of evaluating your model performance. This is a good idea to show this in your summary documentation of the evaluation. So reviewers, you should look for cross-validation results as evidence that the model does a good job. Okay, so what we get, again, using the spherical approach, we got our predictions and our prediction standard errors. And you kind of see here a characteristic of Kriging, which is that the standard errors tend to be low, sort of near the data points, and then they kind of go out from there. So that sort of tends to be what you see here. You know, can kind of see over here we have higher errors because there's not that many samples over there. So, you know, that's, for example, an area where you might want to do some additional sampling and cut down on that uncertainty. All right, so we can combine those and get a 95% upper confidence limit on the mean zinc concentration. So that's something that's shown in this map, and that's quite useful for comparing to risk assessment or other remediation target thresholds. All right, quickly mention a variation on Kriging. So we were looking at some point Kriging results. You can also do Kriging in little blocks. So here I'm showing the results with 100-meter blocks. So sort of instead of giving an estimate at every single point, it gives estimates that are averaged over the block size that you define. So it kind of smooths things out. That could be useful if you're trying to make decisions on blocks. So if you're deciding, you know, which blocks should be excavated, you know, obviously you can only excavate a minimum amount. So you might want to look at things from a block point of view. You know, kind of the results look similar. They're just sort of smoothed out, because they're averaging over these 100-meter square blocks. All right, so as I mentioned, many of the regression types or Kriging approaches really smooth out the data. They smooth out reality in that they underestimate the kind of higher the peaks and overestimate the valleys. So I did want to mention another approach that you can use to get a more realistic depiction of variability. So that's simulation. So here's just a little illustration of it. Here's our data points. And, you know, we're sort of trying to figure out, well, what's going on between the data points? You know, if we were using Kriging, we'd probably just, you know, draw a smooth line between those. But in reality, there could be some, you know, variability, you know, some bumps up and down in between. And we don't know exactly what it is, but we can look at, you know, different possibilities, like, you know, represented by all these different lines. So we kind of simulate the data many different times. So here's some examples. If I take my varigram model and all the data that we've already collected, you can kind of simulate different hypothetical versions of reality that are consistent with both of those things. So here's the first four possibilities. So you see they kind of, you know, look a little simple. They're definitely not smooth. They have a lot of granularity to them. And you want to do this, you know, thousands of times. We do thousands of times, kind of gives us a good sense of what the possibilities are in between those sample locations. And we can summarize that in different ways. So one interesting thing you can do is, let's suppose you are trying to figure out what's the area of what has zinc concentrations above a certain cleanup level, like 1,000 milligrams per kilogram. So for each of those realizations or simulations, we can calculate the area above and then tabulate all those different possibilities into a histogram here. So we see, you know, the most common area of all the simulations is, you know, around a little less than 300 square kilometers. But you get a sense of what the range of possibilities are. If it goes all the way down, you know, below 200 to well above 400. So that can be quite useful for understanding of uncertainty and how that may affect remediation or other decisions you're trying to make. All right, so that was an example of simulation. Another kind of variation on Kriging is co-Kriging, where you're sort of combining two different types of data. And one of the ways where this tends to work best is when you have a combination of coarse samples that are quite accurate, and then sort of very finely samples, another type of sample that's you know, less accurate but covers the entire area of interest. So here's an example where we got kind of point sampling, and then we did some you know, geophysics of electrical conductivity in this case that covers the whole area. So we're sort of trying to take these little points and combine them with this, you know, big spread of data, and kind of get the best estimate we can by combining those two. So there's a bit more details on this in the online guidance, but that's just the kind of the general idea and when you might want to consider it. All right, so just kind of review some things here, just reminders for both reviewers and practitioners too, for when you're putting together the write-up of your work. You want to make sure you describe that method. You know, in particular, if you just say, yeah, I threw my data into the software and this is what I got out, you know, that's not really good enough. You need to be more specific, describe which method you selected, you know, and all the assumptions associated with that method. Did you fit a varigram? What the fit looked like? How did you assess it? You know, how did you pick those other parameters? Hopefully you did some you know, model evaluation using cross-validation, and you considered how accurate the predictions were and how well the uncertainty was. And you know, ultimately, you know, once you get the final results, you should take another hard look at them and compare them with your idea of the conceptual site model in your mind. Are those key features in this of this conceptual model represented in those predictions? Because if they're not, then, you know, that's a pretty big flaw. So that is basically it for this section. And then in the next section, we're going to look a little bit more about putting GRO into practice, and that's going to be presented by Allie Fermal from the Washington Department of Ecology.
Thanks, Chris. You've heard some about the fundamentals of geospatial analysis and seen some examples of how to put that in practice at your site. And now we're going to return to the guidance and learn a little bit about how it's structured and how you can put the guidance to use on your project. And I don't think I have the ability to advance this.
Okay.
I got it. So first, I'd like to point out that there is some companion guidance to the geospatial analysis guidance. ITRC's groundwater statistics for environmental project managers guidance document, and there is a web-based training as well. And the remediation optimization document that Dave spoke about earlier, both are available on ITRC's website and are, this is complementary to those guidance documents. And I want to, take this, to remind, take a moment to remind you that, geospatial analysis is something you already do in your jobs, likely every day, anytime you look at a groundwater contour map or make some assessment from a table of concentrations, at a site, you are making some interpretation based on spatial distribution. So for navigating this guidance, as the ITRC guidance documents have evolved, the layout of the web-based guidance documents has evolved with it. So when you go to the home page of this guidance document, the first thing you'll see are some quick links so that if you already have a particular question in mind or a project lifecycle goal, you can quickly navigate through the guidance to get to answer those questions. But it also includes on a menu on the left-hand side of the screen that can walk you through the different parts of the guidance, and right up top is a section on navigating the guidance to help you understand how things are laid out and related throughout the different pages. I would point out that the glossary for the guidance document is at the bottom of every page, as well as the list of references and acronyms. So within the navigation menu on the left, the next thing you come to are the fact sheets. These fact sheets are high-level overviews that offer an introduction to different categories of topics within the guidance document. They can be downloaded as a PDF or viewed on the screen. The on-screen versions include links to relevant parts of the document. So as you're reading through the fact sheet online, you can go through, get some more information about the material that's being presented. And these fact sheets are really useful tools for communicating with potential clients or regulators or stakeholders to help them understand at a high level some of the fundamentals behind geospatial analysis and optimization and how it relates to the work that's being done. And so this is just a highlight of fact sheet one, which is an introduction to the concepts of geospatial analysis and optimization, and really opens up the question of can geospatial analysis be relevant at your site? How can you use it? Also on the navigation menu on the left side is the Project Manager's Toolbox. The overview there includes links to all four fact sheets, as well as a collection of links to various parts of the guidance document collected together in one spot to make it an easy reference for project managers to start from, before digging in more deeply to the document. And so there you'll find a link to the glossary and the review checklist. And some of the flowcharts and different things that were shown earlier in this presentation, as well as case studies that show you the document, these methods put into practice on real sites. Within the Project Manager's Toolbox is the review checklist. Dave spoke about this briefly. This is basically a step-by-step set of questions that can help you assess your site and make decisions on how you want to use the document and how you the guidance document and how you want to review the results that are presented. It can also be downloaded as a PDF, and it's something that you could, you know, use as a training tool with new staff members or as a documentation of the decisions that are being made throughout the project lifecycle. The project manager's toolbox also includes several flowcharts that to help you select the geospatial analysis method that works best for your specific project needs within your stage of the project lifecycle. It asks you some questions and helps you navigate to different parts of the guidance document that can help you answer those questions. In addition, it also links to the different parts of the document. So if you have questions about what a specific method is or what the data requirements are for it, you can link back to that quickly. And also within the project manager's toolkit is a list of common misapplications that are collected by category, so misapplications within the conceptual site model or the exploratory data analysis, and a big one is model assumptions, you know, having an understanding of the assumptions that are intrinsic to the method or software that you've chosen. And this can be really helpful to avoid pitfalls as you're, you know, using these methods. You know, software will take inputs and produce an output, and it's important to understand the underlying assumptions that are there and the common mistakes that could be made when using these methods. On the left-hand menu, there is a section called Optimization Questions. Within this, there's an overview of different geospatial analysis available for different project lifecycle stages, some other general considerations that you can read through, and the data requirements for each type of method, and for geospatial analysis in general. So this is a flow chart that walks you through answering some questions about the data you have available to evaluate if you can apply a geospatial method at this time, or if you need to collect more data. Also within the optimization questions are a collection of methods for optimization. On the overview of this, it gives you an introduction to the project lifecycle stages and different methods that may be applicable to those. Then within each project lifecycle stage, it shows decisions or needs you may have for your project, such as estimating average concentrations or estimating quantities of a mass of a specific contaminant. And within each section, it shows you which geospatial methods would be most applicable to that need for that project lifecycle stage. And shown here is for site characterization, and you can see the different types of information that are sought and the geospatial methods that might be applicable for seeking those. And they're color-coded to show that if they're a simple, more complex, or advanced method. Under the software tab on the left menu, there are three software comparison tables that have summarized a number of commonly and some less commonly used geospatial software packages. The three tables provide the information about the packages in different formats so that you can view the information based on your project need. Table 7 sorts them by optimization questions. Table 8 includes information on costs and operating systems and other things relevant to the individual software package. And Table 9 lists things by method and describes which types of geospatial methods are available in each software package. So this is a helpful tool to for you to evaluate the software that's available and make some decisions based on your, you know, your available budget or your computing needs or your or the type of information that you seek to get. So this is a little blow up of table 7, and this one as I said, shows the different optimization questions and project lifecycle stages. Each of these tables is available as an Excel file that you can download, so you can sort and filter the information based on your particular project need. And so here, this shows on the left-hand side, you can filter by your project lifecycle stage. So if you're in the site characterization stage, you can filter it to show just data packages that will apply to methods for that particular lifecycle stage. You can also ask a specific question within the lifecycle stage, or if you're looking for plume characteristics or a contaminant, estimating contaminant concentration. And then it lists the software that we've evaluated, and you can filter by that if you know that you already have certain packages available or approved for purchase. And what it does as you filter for these, it qualifies an answer so that you can quickly see if a software package will meet your need for your specific project. There is also a section on using the results. This highlights ways to use and interpret the results that are produced using the geospatial methods. They are categorized by the type of activity and give you some guidance on how to interpret the results you have and how to apply them for decision making. So what we have here is a plume shrinkage example. These three pictures show a reduction in plume area over time, and this can be used to demonstrate to a regulator that remedial goals are being achieved or approaching completion. Can help with decision making. It is important to remember that the results produced by these geospatial methods are a snapshot in time, and you do often need to have some baseline for comparison to show progress. And it's really important to understand the assumptions built into the models and to be able to explain and convey to regulators the assumptions that are intrinsic to the model. This is an example. This is one of the case studies that's provided in the guidance document. And what it's showing is the upper confidence limit of lead concentrations pre and post excavation. And what you can see here are the sample domains that were included in the model. This can help with making decisions about the project remedial actions and if you've achieved the goals prescribed by the regulators or for your project. This also includes the variogram for the geospatial model for this particular site. And to wrap up, geospatial analysis, these methods can be used in support of the conceptual site model and, can help and can be used to present data in a visual fashion and to understand where data has not been collected, but to demonstrate a defensible model for that. They can be used for, demonstrating that projects are achieving remedial goals or where additional sampling is necessary, and can be used to support public meetings and stakeholders and to assure regulators that project goals are being met. It's important to note that there must be spatial correlation in order to use these geospatial methods. And we saw these maps earlier. It is important to remember the method that you choose and the interpolation. It is dependent on the method, and it must be appropriate for your site conditions and for the type of data that you have. And geospatial methods cannot replace professional judgment and an understanding of your site conditions. And just a quick reminder for other uses for the guidance, we focus a lot on contaminant concentrations, but it can also be used to estimate average concentrations and quantity. It can be used for getting information about the plume characteristics if you have a groundwater plume or the evaluating source areas. It can be used to help you prepare your sample model and design your sample spacing so that you are appropriately characterizing your site and avoiding both collecting redundant samples or undersampling. And it can help you optimize your remedial approach if you can eliminate redundant sampling locations or focus resources on an area of greater mass or greater impact. You can save money and time in the long run and achieve your remedial goals more efficiently. And with that, I will turn it back over to Mary to wrap up.
All right, thanks, Allie. We do now have time for questions and answers. So if you have a question, please go ahead and type it in that Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. We would like to get everyone's feedback today, so if you'd please click on that feedback form located in the middle of this slide 111, or you can also access it from the related links section. To access any of the information from the related links section, it's a two-step process where you click on feedback and then click browse too. For those of you needing documentation of continuing education, if you fill out that online feedback form, there's a box towards the end of that form to click to certify you participated today. Once you click that box and press submit, your certificate will be generated for you. If you happen to forget to click the box, just go back into the feedback form, fill it out again, click the box the next time, and submit, and you will get that certificate. I'm going to pull up just a couple more poll questions as we are wrapping up today. If you take a few moments to answer those, we sure would appreciate it. And now we'll move on to some questions. This first one says, can you speak to guidance that EPA has on geospatial analysis or other guidances in addition to what you've discussed?
Yeah, EPA, I don't think, has much specific guidance about geospatial methods. They have a lot of good guidance on sort of generally non-spatial statistical concepts, such as the unified guidance and the series of guidances related to the data quality objectives process. But there's not too much on geospatial methods, and I'm not really thinking of too much other guidance that I can point to. Obviously there's lots of books and references that we've summarized in our online guidance, but in terms of official guidance, I'm not that aware of much out there, but perhaps others can add to that.
Well, this is Dave Becker. There I think was some draft guidance on the application of geostatistics to soil matrix. I think it was like 1997. I don't know that it was ever finalized. So there was some of that, and quick Google search had kind of shown that there may be there's some older guidance from actually the 80s that EPA had on. There's actually a primer on kriging from 1986. The EPA had some software actually that you really can't find or run anymore for geostatistics. And I suppose that the manuals for that had some guidance, but the 1997 guidance and this Cregan guidance, and then there was a developing spatially interpolated surfaces and estimating uncertainty guidance from 2004. So if you do a Google search for EPA and geostatistics, there may be some things out there.
Right. Well, it looks like that's all the questions we have at this point. If we haven't addressed your question fully, please send us an email at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll do our best to follow up. Thanks so much for participating today. We really appreciate the time that you took to be on the line with us. Remember that if your schedule doesn't allow you to participate on one of our sessions live, or we don't have a training coming up in a time frame that's going to meet your needs, we do have archives of most of our sessions, and you can access those archives through the ITRC website. Again, if you'd fill out that feedback form, we'd appreciate it, and that will allow you to get that certificate of participation as well. Thanks so much for our trainers for serving as volunteer trainers for ITRC, and not only for serving on these training sessions, but also for your work over the years to develop the associated guidance document. We very much appreciate your time and ongoing efforts with that. That wraps us up for